This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because these microphones create a virtual Main Street all across our state this time of day. Those real Main Streets that are the centerpieces of our communities, those are important places to meet and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds. And, you know, until the advent of the consolidated school, those Main Streets were probably pretty close to the public schools that were also at the heart of those communities. And education is always an important part of our conversation. Well, Kayla Delzer teaches at Mapleton Elementary School. She also gives talks all over the world about innovations in education. One of her favorite innovation topics concerns flexible seating, allowing kids to pick and choose where they want to sit. Delzer says giving power to students helps them want to learn. And she spoke with Tom Gerhart, host of the Cutting Ed podcast.
You've been at the forefront of innovative education. Can you tell us a little bit about what your light bulb moment was when you knew education needed to change?
For me, it was probably 2011, I think, is the first time I started using iPads in the classroom. I had a technology supervisor there, technology coordinator. His name is Tim Bogley. And he said, Kayla, there's this new sort of computer coming out, and I want to just have you try one in your classroom and see what you can do. So he gave me one iPad, and I started to do some things with it that were new and different than the traditional that I was doing. And he's like, that's kind of cool. He's like, if I give you six iPads, will you share with other teachers what you can do with six iPads? And I was like, I really want the six iPads, but I really am not comfortable getting up in front of teachers and speaking. So I think I'm going to pass. And he brought the six iPads and said, you are going in the media center Tuesday after school to lead a PD on this. And I was like, that really wasn't fair, but okay, I'm in. And so that's kind of for me how it started, was just finding that there were other ways that I could do things that were going to be more motivating, more engaging for kids. And if you follow my journey at all, you know I'm all about using purposeful technology. And so back in 2011, this sort of technology was sort of a novelty, and there wasn't a lot of it. Now, here we are. Almost every classroom has laptops or Chromebooks or iPads, and that's awesome, but it's only awesome if teachers are using it in purposeful ways, and it's not just something that's being used to use it. And if something's boring on paper, it's still boring when you put it with technology. And so it's not the end-all be-all, but I do think that technology in the hands of passionate teachers is going to transform education.
Tell us a little bit about how kids have responded in your classrooms to the use of technology and innovation.
Mm-hmm. These kids have never lived without internet. They've never had dial-up internet. They don't know what that is. They've never not had a screen. 2011, my parents still had dial-up internet in Lakota. Like, that was still till like 2014. Like, literally the last family to get rid of dial-up internet was my family in Lakota. So I think kids definitely respond to not only autonomy, but choice and being able to have different options for things that they're doing. And so I think one of the most innovative things that I'm doing right now, the book I'm actually writing right now is called Flex Ed, Reimagining Spaces for Today's Learners. And so it's all about classroom design and flexible seating. And that all sparked a few years ago at Starbucks. I was getting ready to do my TED Talk. I was super distracted at home, so I would go to Starbucks. That's where I'm productive. That's where I get my work done. And I started really looking at what makes Starbucks a good work environment. And then I thought, like, how can I take what they're doing and actually implement some of that into my classroom? And so that's why my classroom looks the way it does. So my kids don't have assigned seats. They get to choose where they seat based on their productivity level. I don't just tell them that you learn best at this desk facing this part of the room, sitting by these kids and not sitting by these kids, and you're going to do what I tell you to do. Like, my kids get to have a lot of voice and a lot of choice with their seating. And I'm telling you, the results that we're seeing are huge. Health-wise, amazing results. But also, test scores are up. Motivation is up. Engagement is up. Kids are so excited to learn because they don't feel like it's, you know, Ms. Delzer's classroom. They think that it's their classroom. And so it's almost that getting rid of some of the power, and you really get a lot of power back.
Have you been able to share it with other teachers in any of the schools you've been to, and how have other teachers responded to it and seen change?
I wrote about it for EdSurge.com, and that article was published in, I think it was October, end of October. It might have been November. And it was in that year the second most read piece on the entire website, and it had only been published for 2 months. So it told me that teachers were craving something new and innovative and different and non-traditional when it comes to classroom design. And so definitely, I mean, it's been adopted in thousands, tens of thousands of schools around the world now. I've connected with schools in Hong Kong, Australia, places all over the United States that are using the flexible seating model that I wrote about, which is, by the way, just super crazy and humbling, very humbling. I mean, this last fall, it was awarded one of the top 100 most innovative ideas in education in the world. It was given the Global 100 Award, which is, it's crazy. That was an award ceremony in Helsinki, Finland, which is to be among the top 100 most innovative ideas tells you that it's being duplicated.
You've used the term reimagining education a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Explain a little bit more about that concept.
Yeah, so that's what the TED Talk was about, was it's titled Reimagining Education. And so to me, that means thinking about how school was when I went to school and thinking about what is really still best practice and what's still really good stuff that was happening when I was in school. And then what needs to be reimagined or reinvented or redesigned or tweaked or improved or any of those things changed, and just rethinking sort of how we do school and what that means. Like, I talk with my kids all about like living in beta, or like how you have a prototype and you're redesigning things. And they know, like, we're constantly redesigning and learning and changing. And I think that's really important as teachers, because if we're asking our kids to be constantly learning new things all the time, shouldn't we also as teachers be willing to learn new things all the time? I think that's really important. And so I just try to like read a lot of books and stay connected through social media with my PLN on Twitter and Instagram, and of course different Facebook groups, and really just try to find the best of the best and start implementing it in my classroom. And that's not to say that everything that happened when I went to school is terrible, because it's not. I had a wonderful experience, but I have changed a lot of what I do even since my first year of teaching. And so it's just sort of, I think just, it doesn't have to be big things that you change. Sometimes it's just little things that you change. And what that means to me is being innovative, being willing to take risks, being willing to, you know, set up the student-led social media accounts and hold those kids' hands. And that's not something that I had when I was growing up. And thank goodness, like, when I grew up, we didn't have any of that thing. So, like, when I made a mistake, like, nobody knew about it. Now when kids make mistakes, it's for the world to see. So that's just one way to reimagine, you know. That's part of our job as teachers, I think.
We've talked about how critical technology is, mm-hmm. how useful it can be. Mm-hmm. But the teacher is still the most important resource in the classroom, correct? Mm-hmm. So how have you been able to fuse yourself with technology mm-hmm. to put out the best possible product?
I think you just literally worded that perfectly. So I say, like, 50 years ago, the teacher was the most important part of the classroom. Today, the teacher is the foundation of successful classrooms. And I think, you know, 50 years from now, the technology that we're going to use, we have no idea. It's going to be bananas what our kids are going to be using. But the teacher is still going to be the most important part of the classroom, because the difference maker between technology and teachers is that teachers are humans. Teachers can empathize. Teachers make relationships with students. And that is the heart of the classroom, relationships between students and teachers. And that will always be the heart of the classroom. And so for me, it's relationships first all day long, every single day. And I live that to my core. If the technology is going to improve what we're doing or change what we're doing, then I use it. If it's going to be purposeful, I'll use it. I'll just share one way that we use technology in our classroom that I feel like is really a powerful tool, is an app that's called Seesaw. And I'm not by any means sponsored by them or getting any kind of endorsement by saying that I like Seesaw, but it's a powerful tool in our classroom. It's actually a digital portfolio. Kids can take pictures or screen shares or videos of their work, and they can annotate their work, which I think is really powerful, because so often we have kids fill out a paper and it goes in the basket on the desk, and you might grade it like a week later, or maybe you don't even grade it, and then they get it back. And do we really know if a kid understands just because what's on paper? You know, so what Seesaw allows me to do is they actually have to annotate what's on the screen, and they have to explain their thinking and how they got their answer. And then The cool part about it is it gets to me and I can approve it or I cannot approve it. And then it goes to a class feed and other students can leave feedback for them. So think about the world that we live in right now. Think about when you travel. If you're going to go to try out a new restaurant, what do? You look at ratings, right? I go on Yelp. I'm looking at what are the best ratings, and I need to look at how to leave feedback. And that's important for our kids, too. So my kids get to leave. We have feedback Fridays. They leave feedback for other students about what they're liking about their work and what they have questions about. The cool piece, the third piece of Seesaw, is after I approve it, parents are connected with their students' journals. Parents get a notification that there's activity in their kids' journal. And the parents are commenting, and the parents are leaving feedback. Parents are feeling involved and like they know what's going on in their child's education. And so that's a powerful tool on many, many, many levels. That's an innovative tool that I can't do with just a paper and a pencil.
Is there more we could do to promote innovative education in North Dakota?
The conferences that we have are great. I think having people come to the conference, hear about the conference, but the hard thing is to get people to go to the conferences. Podcasts like this, getting the word out, I think is crucial. Of course, I'm always, always reading. I've got like 17 books going at the same time, all the time. But I think just reading and getting a professional learning network established, getting connected with other teachers on Twitter, getting connected on Instagram, because my friend George Curl says that if you're feeling isolated as an educator, that's a choice that you're making, because it is so easy to get inspired on Twitter by people who are doing amazing things. And I always just try to share from my classroom too, because what I think is maybe just ordinary might be somebody's extraordinary moment. Just really challenge teachers to be bold and to be brave, because it can be scary to post your stuff. It can be scary to put your ideas out there. And one of my students actually last year, he said that I signed my book contract with my students because it's always been a dream to write a book. And I wanted to show them like anybody can be a writer and writing matters. And this is a real book that's going to be published. And I signed my book contract. And right after I signed it, one of my students, he came up to me and he said, "I feel like this is being really brave of you." And I was like, what do you mean that it's being really brave? He's like, "When you write this down and you say that the relationships are the most important part of the classroom and not science and not math or not social studies," he's like, "there's going to be some people who probably are going to disagree with you. So I think you're being really brave by writing about it anyways." And that honestly was a pivotal moment in my career, because kids get it.
You do a lot outside the classroom that shines a light on reimagining mm-hmm. education. Mm-hmm. You've talked a little bit about it, but tell us why that aspect is so important.
Pernille Rip is one of my friends. She founded the Global Read Aloud Project. She connected 3.2 million people through a book. That is one of the most humbling experiences in the world, is being around someone who, A, came up with that idea, and B, connected that many people in a meaningful way around literature. That's super inspiring and super humbling. So for me, the reimagining piece is just surrounding yourself with people who get it, whether that's outside of your school or inside your school or online. They say that you're the average of the five people you spend your most time with. Critically looking at that and reevaluating who are your five people is really important, I think, for teachers.
How has reimagining helped you grow as a teacher?
Anytime that you're learning something new, no matter what you're learning, it's hard at first. And so for me, it's taught me a lot about perseverance. I even said when I started flexible seating, I was going to give myself till October 31st. And then if it didn't work, I could bail. And I don't do that anymore now. I say, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do this. And we're going all in. Reimagining education has, I think, just open my mind too to new ideas, and that the way things have always been done is maybe not the best way. So if it is the best way, that's fabulous. Let's keep doing it. And if it's not, or we can take that idea and tweak it a little bit, then let's try it. Education needs to be changing. It's been the same for 100 years. So I think like it's done a lot of different things in my life, but for sure it's taught me about confidence, perseverance, and bravery, and all of those things.
Elementary school teacher Kayla Delzer with Cutting Ed podcast host Tom Gerhart. We'll have more of their conversation in a moment.
We've heard the Me Too movement loud and clear. Now, How do we transform awareness into meaningful change? Join WNYC for a national conversation where we explore how to ignite workplace culture shifts, punishments that fit the crimes, and greater responsibility from men. Beyond Me Too, women, men, power, and change.
Join Prairie Public for this special four-part live series, Beyond Me Too, Monday through Thursday of this week at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and as you just heard, the rebroadcast of Main Street will be preempted this evening through Thursday for the special series, Beyond Me Too. We'll talk with Jamie Floyd, one of the hosts, later in this show. Now we'll return to the conversation about innovations in education with teacher Kayla Delzer and Cutting Edge podcast host Tom Gerhardt.
We've heard a lot about how kids have more fun coming to school from a variety of people. How about you? Is it more fun as a teacher? Do you look, you can't wait to get to
it
school in the morning?
Definitely more fun. I wish that my students were here right now to answer this question, but they will tell you I smile all day long. One student actually told me yesterday, she's like, I didn't know what to expect the first day of school. She's like, I thought I was kind of weird because you smiled all day long at us. And I just laughed at her. And I tell my kids I drive to school smiling and excited. And at the end of the day, I'm still smiling and I'm still really excited. And I think every day's a little bit different and it is exciting and it's a different world in education now than it was even 10 years ago. So I'm definitely counting my blessings, definitely feeling very lucky to be teaching here with these kids. And it's definitely, my kids love coming to school, which I think is the number one goal of education, is kids need to love school and they need to love learning. And as a teacher, I love my job. I love that I get to come and spend my day with amazing kids and a fabulous staff here.
I'm going to ask you to hand out some advice, if you will. First, let's talk about teachers that have been in the field a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe, I don't know if resistance is the right word, but maybe just need a little roadmap to point them in the right direction.
Yeah. So I think like the shining star example of this is my mom. So I mentioned my mom earlier, and why I became a teacher was my mom's kindergarten classroom. And so she actually has taught kindergarten for 42 years. Which to me is, yes, it's almost like I can't even really wrap my head around it for two reasons. Like, one, 42 years is a long time to teach. And two, kindergarten is like just a whole different beast. It's hard. I give so many props to teachers that teach kindergarten because, like, they're just earning jewels in their crown because I just have so much respect for them. So my mom actually had just announced that this is her last year of teaching. So she's retiring this year. But I think that my mom is the prime example of like a veteran teacher who's still trying things. Like she's doing flexible seating this year. She has CESA accounts for kindergarten. But she also still does awesome things with like real books with the Snuggle Time reading program. And she's a good mix of what she's always done that's still really good stuff, but also thinking about how can she make it even better. And so I think it would be overwhelming to think you need to do all of the things because you don't need to do all of the things. So pick one thing that you can change in your classroom this year that you can just try and know that if it's not for you or if it didn't work for you, like you can try something else, you know, next year. But be open and willing to try, you know, some things because education has changed.
And conversely, young teachers, new teachers,
yeah,
looking for direction.
Yeah, so that is something when I spoke at UND this fall, I really encouraged teachers, young teachers, to get in other teachers' classrooms. Get in classrooms, many other grade levels, different styles of teachers. Get into classrooms, see what teaching is like, and see what's working for those teachers and what's not working for those teachers. And here's the thing, like when teachers get into other teachers' classrooms, they never leave the classroom stealing the worst ideas. They only steal the best ideas. But if you don't get into those classrooms and see those ideas, you're missing out on so much. So get into those classrooms. And again, I tell those teachers, it's actually part of the beginning of my presentation. I have this slide that has the hashtag for the event. And I'm like, how many of you are on Twitter? And there's usually like three hands. And I'm like, Okay, so everything I'm about to tell you right now, you can find probably from a lot of powerful people and smart people on Twitter. And so the knowledge that's on Twitter exceeds what I'm doing in my classroom and what I'm going to talk about here tonight. So let's get you set up on Twitter. Let's follow these 40 people. And it's amazing what you can get on Twitter even in 10 minutes if you're following the right people. Like, if you're only following Justin Bieber and Kim Kardashian, like, that's all your Twitter feed is going to be. But if you follow Todd Whitaker or George Kuros or Pernille Rip, like, you're gonna be so inspired to try new ideas because you're seeing that it's working in their classroom. So I encourage new teachers to get in other people's classrooms and start the Professional Learning Network, on whether it's on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or all of the things, but get connected for sure. And if that's something that young teachers who are hearing this want to do but you're not sure how to start, follow my Twitter account at Top Dog Teaching. Send me a message and I can give you a quick start list of, like, here's at least five people that you should be following that are going to inspire you.
Let's end with this idea of relationships, which seems to be, before you even get into the classroom, something that's so critical to you. It's your pinned tweet.
Yeah.
Do you still do something special for each student every Friday?
Every Friday. Yes, I do. And so every Friday is fondly called hashtag Love Note Friday. And so what happens in my classroom on Friday is every single kid knows that they're going to get a love note from me, which is basically, if you know anything about Gary Chapman's, he wrote a book called The Love Languages. Basically, every person has a love language, and kids have love languages too. And one of the love languages is just called words of affirmation. And so I think it's super critical as teachers that we're pointing out with kids things that we are seeing them do right, because I think it's really easy to point out things that we're seeing kids do wrong. And so my goal is always for kids to feel so empowered and so loved and so valued and so worthy and so important. And so every single Friday I write them a sticky note. It's just literally a tiny sticky note, just says something that I noticed that they're doing this week that I think is awesome. And I line them all up on the mailboxes and they take it home or they keep it in their binder. And they loved getting that. And I'll also just write, I think the same goes for teachers. I write notes to other teachers all the time about, like, oh, you're doing great. Or I overheard your mini lesson in writing and that was amazing. Like, I'd love to be a student in your class. And I think it's a little thing that's a big thing. And so words of affirmation in my classroom is something I do every single Friday. I also greet my kids at the door every single day. And I give them a hug, a handshake, or a high five. And I say good morning. And I say their name. And I ask how they're doing. And I do a quick check with them. And then they come in and they start their morning routines. And it's not weird for them to give me a hug. It's not weird for them to come up to me and connect with me about something that's going on at home because they feel comfortable. And my favorite TED Talk actually is by Rita Pearson, Every Child Deserves a Champion. And she talks about how kids don't learn from teachers that they don't like. And I really take that to heart. Not that you need to be your kid's best friend, but I do think they need to like you and respect you and value you, and they need to know that you love them too, and I think that's critical.
That was Mapleton Elementary School teacher Kayla Delzer, who's an advocate for innovations in education. She spoke with Tom Gerhart, host of the Cutting Ed podcast, which is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dintersmith. Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear from Jamie Floyd, one of the hosts for Beyond Me Too, a special public radio series about sexual harassment. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. After a two-year delay, North Dakota's lawsuit over the Federal Waters of the U.S. Act could soon be back in U.S. District Court. Attorney General Wayne Stengem says the unanimous decision was handed down today, or this morning, by the Supreme Court.
We think that's important because we have succeeded in getting an injunction against enforcement of the Waters of the U.S. rule here in North Dakota, and we're anxious to pick up that litigation.
Stengem says the determination allows his office to file a motion to proceed with the lawsuit in district court. 12 states have joined North Dakota in calling to end the act. Stengem says he is hoping the state will get to lead the proceedings.
One of the major concerns that we had was that the rule took up and claimed federal jurisdiction over the prairie potholes that cover half or more of North Dakota, even though they don't connect to any navigable waters.
Stenjum says the waters of the U.S. was developed by the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency to replace provisions under the Clean Water Act. He says instead of improvements, we received a massive government overreach. The recent frigid weather across the Midwest has slowed down river barges that are carrying grain to shipment ports. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted says some experts say it puts the U.S. export market at risk.
Barge traffic destined for the Gulf of Mexico is crawling along the Mississippi, Ohio, and Illinois rivers due to heavy ice buildups. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says that in the first 2 weeks of 2018, barges have carried 60% less grain compared to last year. That troubles Mike Steenhook, the executive director of the Soy Transportation Coalition, who says the cold weather is encumbering farmers' ability to meet export demand.
And for soybeans, it's particularly acute because 80% of our exports occur between the months of September and February. So this is a real key time, an opportune time for us to meet that international demand.
Steenhook says the fear is if not enough grain makes it to port, countries like China will turn to Argentina and Brazil for grain. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
And the flu season continues to escalate in North Dakota. Jill Baber is influenza surveillance coordinator with the North Dakota Department of Health. She says last week saw a surge in flu cases.
We're up to about 2,520 lab-confirmed cases, and we know that that amount pales in comparison to the actual number of cases just because these are only the lab confirmed specimen that we count. And all of our other indicators last week went up as well, so we know flu is definitely still widespread.
Baber says 10 deaths have been attributed to the flu in North Dakota so far this year, but those numbers are still fairly typical. She says each patient was over the age of 65. Baber says despite the widespread nature of this year's flu season, it's still important to get a flu shot.
One of the reasons you want to get a flu shot is because even when the vaccine doesn't completely prevent flu, we do see people with fewer symptoms, less severe symptoms. People are missing less work and less school. And so the flu can be pretty serious for pretty much everyone. And so even when it isn't perfect, it's still providing you some level of protection.
Baber says it's also not too late to get a flu shot. She says sometimes flu seasons can come in waves, and getting a shot can ensure your protection. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Jamie Floyd. She hosts WNYC, that's New York's public radio station, the All Things Considered show on that station. But she's also hosting Beyond Hashtag Me Too, which is a four-part radio series from WNYC that will be airing on Prairie Public starting this evening at 7 through Thursday of this week. And she joins us from New York City. Thanks for being with us, Jamie.
Hello, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this project. Of course, we've been hearing about Me Too and hashtag, you know, that all those things. When did this project actually get started?
Well, we've been talking about this for several weeks. Like you, we've been mired in Me Too for over 100 days. Now, you're probably thinking, 100 days, is that all? But that's it. It's just been a few months. October is when the Harvey Weinstein story broke, and then the avalanche of Me Too. And we decided several weeks ago that we want to try to get beyond Me Too, move the conversation forward, start to talk about how to change the workplace and correct the problem. We're also going to have a night focused on what men can do to be part of the solution, and also talk about families and how to raise children going forward. So we're trying to be part of the solution and get beyond just talking about the problem.
So is this a sea change in cultural history? Or do you agree with those who say that recent events have fundamentally changed the way we talk about and react to sexual power plays?
I definitely think we have changed forever the way we talk about and the way we react to sexual politics, to sexism, and to sexual harassment and misconduct. The question is what we're going to do about it. It can't just be talk. It has to be action. And so that's why we are going to do this special series called Beyond Me Too.
And do you hashtag Me Too bring personal experience to this?
Well, I have to say that I don't think there's a woman above the age of 20 who hasn't had some experience with it. I mean, I remember as a very small a girl walking down the street with my mother, Doug, and having men make comments to my mother. And she was with her daughter, me, on the streets of New York City. And she was an attractive woman, and men wouldn't hesitate to make comments. And that was, you know, that made a tremendous impression on me. And then as I got older, men, similar men, would make comments. You'd learn to cross the street when you saw a construction site or men at work. And this was just part of the culture. And then the movies, the commercials, the sexualization and objectification of women. And then you get into the workplace and you have to navigate that workplace. And slowly we saw, Doug, that we would take this on in cultural ways. Mary Tyler Moore, Murphy Brown, storylines even programs that weren't about women in the workplace, programs like ER come to mind as we moved forward. But we had Anita Hill, of course. That was a very formative moment for me. I was in law school at the time. But we haven't ever had an avalanche like this. So I think this is a sea change, as you say, and it has been a part of my experience, and I think it has been a part of so many, of almost every woman's experience, but we hope going forward it won't be for our daughters and our granddaughters. And I do want to say also, Doug, men have been victims too. We cannot leave out the male victims. Not as many men, but there have been men as well.
Is the New York City wolf whistle likely to be silenced?
You know, I think men are thinking twice. Certainly in the workplace. The workplace is it's different over the course of the last 3 months. I've noticed it. I've noticed it walking down the street. I've noticed it on the subway. I don't know what your public transportation situation is in Fargo, but it's very, very, very crowded here in New York, and people are suddenly much more aware of their surroundings, much more self-possessed. And I think that's a good thing. Now, I think the culture has to shift back. I mean, I do think we have to have conversations. We have to be very considered and thoughtful going forward. We certainly don't want a backlash. We don't want false accusations. So this is going to be a long path forward. This isn't going to be a short snap. And that's why we're doing Beyond Me Too. We think this is the beginning of a conversation, not the end point.
Jamie Floyd is one of the hosts of Beyond Hashtag Me Too. It's a WNYC public radio special production that will begin this evening at 7 Central on Prairie Public and extend through Thursday of this week. And, Jamie, the first episode is Designing the Harassment-Free Workplace. How do you do that?
Well, we're going to be talking with a number of guests. We're going to start with a law professor who has spent 30 years studying sexual harassment and misconduct in the workplace and beyond. But then, Doug, we are going to speak with domestic workers, restaurant workers, and advocates for those people. You can't do it from the top down. You can't just talk to the ivory tower. You really have to get into the DNA of these institutions. And I think that's how you restructure the workplace. And Me Too has thus far been so much about the red carpet and even the Golden Globes recently. But if you watch the Golden Globes, you saw a lot of those well-known actors brought advocates for real women to the Golden Globes. And so now we're trying to expand that movement to be about the thousands of women who are in the shadows of the economy who are suffering sexual harassment and misconduct every day and indeed assault. So I think it is about changing the DNA, not just of these institutions, Doug, but of our society. That's what the movement has to become. And that's why people are saying time's up now. Time's up has become the new cry.
Well, when Harvey Weinstein made his famous fall and it came with a terrible thud, the reaction in lots of places, probably including in Hollywood, was let's double down on diversity training. Is that the solution?
Well, you know, studies show, surprisingly, that the training really doesn't work. And in fact, we're going to be speaking with a woman on my program tonight from Harvard, who's part of a group at Harvard who have done all kinds of studies that demonstrate that the training doesn't seem to work. All kinds of training, whether you do live in-person training, video training, whatever you do, if for whatever reason, it just doesn't stick. The real, as you suggest, when you say the word diversity, Doug, the real solution is diversity. You have to get women into positions of power in these organizations. If women are managers, if women are in positions of leadership, and of course also right-minded men, but it's about sharing a power at the table, and also people of color, because some of this has revealed as well discrimination against people of color. Many of the stories have been about that as well. So it is again about changing the DNA of these institutions and of society. And the Harvey Weinstein story just it was a crack in the door. It opened the door to a much larger problem, I think, as we've all come to see.
Well, this problem, as it is pervasive. It's been out there all of our lives and likely will continue in some fashion somehow until we have actual diversity, the real kind of diversity in leadership, mm-hmm. legislatures mm-hmm. and Congress
yes.
and
yes.
That kind of thing.
Yes, and Congress has been, you know, it, hardly an institution, Doug, hasn't been touched by a Me Too moment. And Congress, as we've all seen, has been among them. And they're now going through their own institutional regrouping. And we've had resignations. We've had people say, oh, I'm not going to run again. Only the beginning, I think. And there certainly are not enough women and clearly not a representational number of women on Capitol Hill or in the state houses, the city councils across this country. So that is a perfect example of what we're talking about. And I think as we continue to investigate Me Too, we are going to see, I painfully hesitate to say, more examples of problems in government across this country.
Well, episode one this evening, Designing the Harassment-Free Workplace, is part one of Beyond the Hashtag Me Too Movement. Episode two, Tuesday evening, Our Kids. Well, you've got a couple of kids, so
yeah.
tell us how you're dealing with that.
Oh, my goodness, that has been so difficult. I've always believed, and listen, I don't ever, ever dare to tell someone else how to raise children because it is the most difficult and most important thing one will ever do. But I have always believed, my husband and I have always believed, to speak as openly and honestly with children about these issues of sex and sexuality and unfortunately, predators as early as you possibly can. And it's so painful because you want them to retain their innocence for as long as they can. And unfortunately, in our society, that's not possible for very long. And then, of course, there's the hypersexualization of everything that's out there. There are only a few things that are sweet and innocent for very long in a child's life in our society. So we've been very, very clear and honest with our kids. Now, my kids are 15 and 18. So this has not been a conversation we could avoid with them. They are aware of what is happening. They know who these victims are. They know the Harvey Weinstein victims. They know who Kevin Spacey is. They know who Louis C.K. I mean, I can go through the list. And every day a story drops, they are aware of it. Of course, they have iPhones. The pop-ups. They have the New York Times pop-up. They come running to me and they tell me the headline, Doug, before I tell them the headline. So there's no option but honesty with the kids right now. Now, if you have a kid who's 10, that's a dreadfully difficult situation. If you have a kid who's 3, you are so lucky. Because they're missing this moment. you have a few years before you have to address it. But you know, we're trying right now to make a better world for those kids who are 3 and 2 and 1. And my daughter, who's 18, about to be 19, she can stand in the power of this moment. And my son as well. My husband and I are working to raise a son who respects women and who will not ever victimize a woman. And we are raising a daughter who will not be a victim. And that is the important message for children, I believe, Doug.
Well, you mentioned those three-year-olds. There are probably a lot of three-year-olds who are spend the afternoon or their waking hours watching a fair amount of TV, maybe some animated cartoon, which might reinforce some stereotyped model of behavior.
Absolutely, Doug. And I remember when my children were very young, spending a lot of time thinking about fairy tales, thinking about the images, whether they are subconscious images or overt images. When children watch princess movies or, the heroes that are put forward, whether the males are, put forward as the superheroes and the women are in a supportive role, running in heels alongside the male.
Ginger Rogers could do it what Fred Astaire did backwards.
That's exactly right. And look, I'm a romantic. I love a lot of those old movies, but you do have to recognize what the messages are to a young girl at the age of three, at the age of five. My daughter loves Shirley Temple, and I still love Shirley Temple. I don't want to take anything away from the ambassador. She became an ambassador, so she was a wonderful woman. But you do have to think a lot about the messages you're sending, even to a three-year-old. So it starts very, very early. I do agree with you, Doug. But I don't know that we have to talk about Me Too with a three-year-old.
Episode 3 is The Corrections. That's Wednesday evening. Yeah. So what are The Corrections?
Oh, my goodness. Well, what's so difficult about The Corrections is we have such a broad range of behavior. And we are going to talk tonight about everything from the Aziz Ansari allegations to Harvey Weinstein. So then when you get to corrections, how do you assess the different allegations as against the possible corrections, the consequences? And who decides the corrections? Should it be the victim? Should it be a judge or a jury? Do we even get to a courtroom? Or should it be some sort of civil penalty? Should it be a financial reward to the victim? Should it be a societal penalty? So that's what corrections are about. And that's an intensely important hour, and it will be an intense hour for the listeners, but very, very, very critically important for everyone to tune in.
Well, you were trained in the law. There are laws that are supposed to address sexual assault and harassment. Are they sufficient?
Well, first of all, harassment tends to be about the workplace, and assault and rape is a criminal matter. And sometimes there's an intersection, as we see in the Weinstein case, but very often there isn't. What Anita Hill alleged against Clarence Thomas, though would violate workplace rules about harassment, never rose to the level of a criminal complaint. So it wouldn't be sufficient in the minds of some people. And it really varies from case to case and from victim to victim. One victim might be satisfied with what the law provides, and another victim might be terribly dissatisfied. And in criminal court, the law doesn't even contemplate the victim. The law is not about the victim in criminal court. It is about the defendant and the jury and the prosecutor and justice. The victim doesn't come into it at all if you read the Constitution. Whether that's right or not, I don't know. I mean, our Constitution would have to be revisited to contemplate the victim in criminal court. In civil court, it does. So that's why the corrections hour is so critically important, because this Me Too moment has been very much about the victim. And I believe it should be. But there does come a point where we do have to think about the alleged perpetrators, whether they've been rightly accused, and when they've been accused, what's the right outcome? Should we seek treatment for them? How do we get them to atone for what they've done? And what is it that we want from them in order to feel fully compensated for the wrong they've allegedly perpetrated?
Well, just under half of the population of the planet is male, so that's episode 4, Thursday evening, The Men. How do you address the gender difference here?
Well, Kai Wright is hosting that episode, my colleague and editor here in our newsroom, formerly of The Nation. And, you know, in one of the interviews I conducted for my night, Jen Ag, who's a restaurateur from Toronto, said rightly, we cannot solve this problem without men. In fact, without the men, we will not move forward. And if men are the perpetrators most of the time, far and away, by far the perpetrators in these terrible cases, then we're certainly not going to move forward in sexual harassment and assault. And even if we take out the worst cases and we're simply talking about workplace harassment and discrimination in the workplace and a culture that oppresses women, we're not going to change that culture and the DNA of our society without men participating in that change. And so that's what that last night is about, bringing men into the conversation, because thus far, Me Too, although many men have been participating in, for example, the Women's March on Sunday, the marches around the country, there were many, many men out there, and they participated last year as well and have been very active and vocal in the Me Too moment and movement. It has been largely an outcry on the part of women. And so now we want to get men actively engaged in constructing a solution.
We should mention that public radio and WNYC in particular have had their own issues. John Hockenberry, the former host of The Takeaway, Jonathan Schwartz, other people have been disciplined or removed from their work. How do the chips fall where you work?
Yes, indeed. We've had three very prominent hosts accused of sexual misconduct. And as you say, all three are gone from our station. And we continue to assess what went wrong, Doug, to investigate what went wrong and to try to figure out, you know, as I've said several times in this conversation, the DNA of our organization, because it is a societal problem. It is, you know, there's no institution that really hasn't had a Me Too moment or isn't going to have one. It's hitting every industry, not just media, not just journalism, sports and the symphonies and schools and, you know, I could go on. So we are not immune, and we've been very transparent, and we have reporters working on it independently in our newsroom. But the engagement around the issue is real here, and we will be talking about it during the series as we proceed with the Me Too, beyond Me Too, as we're calling it.
Jamie Floyd with WNYC Public Radio in New York City, part of the Beyond Me Too project, which begins this evening at 7 p.m. Central on Prairie Public's radio network, runs through Thursday. Again, it's actually preempting Main Street's replay at 7 o'clock. And this is a very important series. We appreciate you spending a bit of time with our listeners, Jamie.
Thank you. And listeners will be able to spend time with us because they can call in.
Very good. It's interactive. Decoded Datebook is next.
For I cannot find the words to say, I need you so.
Valentine's Day is coming, and among other things, it's time for poetry. Rita Dove gets romantic. She said, "My heart is humming a tune I haven't heard in years. Quiet's cool flesh, let's sniff and eat it. There are ways to make of the moment a topiary, so the pleasure's in walking through." And in another poem, she says, "Chocolate, velvet fruit, exquisite square, I hold up to sniff between finger and thumb, how you numb me with your rich attentions." Yes, chocolate and love, they go together. And so Prairie Public has got it all set up with the Short and Sweet Drive. Make a contribution of $10 a month, $120 a year, and we will send out a one-pound box of delicious handmade cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry in time for Valentine's Day. We'll even write a message on a card to go in the box. Go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
This is Decoded Datebook for January 22nd. On this date in 1915, the Sioux County Pioneer reported on a meeting at Fort Yates. the 10 members of the permanent committee representing the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation gathered to discuss the matter of Pahasapa, the Black Hills. The council considered a letter from the Commissioner of Indian Affairs to the council at Pine Ridge, South Dakota. The commissioner suggested that members of the Nine Nations of the Sioux should prepare a legal argument regarding the $7 million claim that the Sioux said was due them. This claim stemmed from the breaking of the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. This treaty designated the Black Hills as the Great Sioux Reservation. According to the treaty, the Black Hills were exempt from white settlement forever. But in 1874, George Armstrong Custer led an expedition into the Black Hills, and word got out that gold was found. Prospectors swarmed into the area. In 1876, a new agreement took precedence over the earlier treaty, and the United States took claim of the Black Hills. The Sioux were sent to five smaller reservations in 1889. The move was very much against their will, as it violated the 1868 treaty and forced them onto much smaller tracts of land. 9 million acres of the Black Hills were subsequently sold to ranchers and farmers. In 1915, Congress was poised to approve $10,000 to investigate the claims of the Sioux. In preparation for the investigation, the council at Standing Rock named Ben White to gather depositions of 13 signers of the 1876 treaty. The depositions and other evidence would be sent to an attorney in Washington representing the Sioux. The matter of the Black Hills remains unsettled today. A 1980 Supreme Court ruling agreed that the Black Hills were taken illegally. The court ordered repayment of the initial offering price plus interest, nearly $106 million. The Sioux wanted the Black Hills returned and refused the money. The money remains untouched in an interest-bearing account. As of 2015, it amounted to over $1 billion. The Sioux believe that accepting the money would allow the government to justify taking the Black Hills. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Many Americans these days are doing freelance or contract work, but few of them receive benefits or other considerations that come with steady jobs.
Freelancers aren't entitled to unemployment insurance, and this is really bad for low-wage workers in particular.
Holes in the social safety net for contract workers. That's on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Tuesday on Main Street, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum will deliver his second State of the State address. This one will follow his first full year in office. And last year, the governor urged us to embrace change, to rethink budgeting and rethink education, addiction treatment, and tribal relations. On Tuesday, we'll talk about his 2018 message and the issues it raises and hear analysis about progress so far. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.